This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For about a year now, America's hospitals have been experiencing a shortage of drugs. And we're not talking about Tylenol or blood pressure medication. We're talking about chemotherapy drugs, anesthetics, drugs that can mean the difference between life and death. Last week, WFAE News took a look at the problem. Our Michael Tomczyk produced a series of reports on what one official has referred to as the new normal at hospital pharmacies. Michael has spent a considerable amount of time researching why this is happening, how hospitals, doctors, and patients are coping, and what is being done to reverse the shortage. He learned far more than he could put into his week-long series, so we invited him to join us for the hour to tell us more. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Mike, thanks.
It's been since the Democratic National Convention. You've switched gears on it.
I know. It's been a while.
We are also joined by two professionals who know about this problem firsthand because they deal with it every day. Bob Carta is Vice President of Pharmacy Services at Carolina's Healthcare System. He joins us here in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome back to you.
Thank you, Mike.
And Jay Campbell is Executive Director of the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy. He joins us by phone from Chapel Hill. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Michael, you called your series Critical Supply, and from listening to it, the word critical has a double meaning. Obviously, these are drugs that are in a critical supply shortage, and also they are critical drugs to many people who have to take them. And you spoke with Novant's vice president of pharmacy, who has been in the business for 20 years, who said he's never seen anything like this. Every year, he said, we think that the next year is going to be better, but unfortunately, it appears to be getting worse. So when did this start?
It's been a couple years that it's been really severe, right, Bob? Because I remember, and it's kind of gone through phases too. So when it first started, one of the major issues were the oncology drugs, the cancer drugs, the chemotherapy treatments. And it's kind of gone through these phases where it's gone from, you know, there was this one time where those were the ones that were in the most critical shortages. Then it kind of went to anesthetics, and then from there it's kind of even moved on to a lot of the basic stuff, like you said in the open. I mean, we're talking electrolytes and vitamins that you have in your IV fluid. So stuff that you would never think, this may be an issue for me if I go to a hospital, or am I going to be able to get the basic stuff I need in my IV fluids?
And you talked to Novant's Michael Noddy, who said things are getting worse. And Bob, would you agree at Carolina's healthcare system that things are getting worse every year?
The drug shortage problem in the United States is definitely getting worse. Over the last 3 years, it's intensified. 2012 has not shown there's over 200 drugs right now on national back order.
So characterize this, Jay. How big a problem is this? How critical is this? How concerned should we be?
Now, Bob is exactly right. It's a critical access problem. It has not resolved. I don't know that there's a single cause for it, but it does particularly put health systems like CMC, Novant, et cetera, in a particular bind. I think perhaps what was mentioned is some of these, you mentioned chemotherapy agents and the other things, but sometimes what's missing are basic electrolyte solutions, which are needed for every type of IV therapy you can imagine. So it's a real problem.
And one more piece of perspective, Mike, on, you know, this problem and kind of the trend with it. At the end of last year, one of the main organizations that monitors the total number of shortages, it's the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. At the fourth quarter of 2012, so the end of last year, they found it was about 299 drug shortages, which was the most that they had ever found in as long as they've been tracking. So, I mean, there's some debate about how whether some of the more recent actions have improved, and I'm sure we'll get to that later in the show. But at least on the hospital side of things, from my understanding from everyone I've talked to, they're not seeing any improvement. They're seeing this continue to grow.
Yeah, I went on a website. There's a couple of websites you can go on to check on which drugs are in short supply today, or this month, or last month. And there are literally hundreds of them, hundreds of them. This obviously is something you deal with, Bob, every single day. And I know you have a person dedicated at the CMC to dealing with the drug shortage and trying to, find a drug here and move it there and make sure that hospitals have what they need. If every hospital in the country is facing this and has faced it for years and years and years, why isn't there a hue and cry? Why hasn't there been a congressional investigation into this?
Well, you know, I mean, the FDA has oversight of drug shortages, but it's a very lax program. There's personnel. There's lack of personnel within the FDA. The drug manufacturers have to notify the FDA 6 months in advance if there's going to be a medically necessary drug shortage, a drug that's medically necessary. Unfortunately, there's no fines that the FDA
couldn't it be argued that all drugs are medically necessary? Otherwise, they wouldn't
exist. Well, that's the problem. They don't define medically necessary. So, yes, all drugs are medically necessary. So it's a very lax system. And there's no fines that can be levied by the FDA to the drug manufacturers.
Is it deliberately lax, or is it simply an oversight, an unintended consequence of not wanting to write too much into regulation?
It's probably not trying to write too much into legislation.
But this did not happen in 1995.
Well, you know, if you look at the whole problem with drug shortages, most of the drugs on drug shortages, and Mike is right, they are chemo, morphine, a lot of your pain medication, a lot of your anesthetics. Most of those drugs are generic. And so it becomes sort of, you know, sometimes generic drugs do not provide profits to the drug companies.
Yes, we're going to get to that in a second. the pharmacy director at Carolina's healthcare system, your hospital, showed Michael an emergency tray for heart attack patients. This is a tray that would be in either the emergency room or at the nurse's station on a floor. And if somebody has a heart attack, they'd simply grab the tray and run to the patient with it. And that tray has on it all the things that a person would need to deal with that problem. And he told Michael that almost every drug on the tray is in short supply. What are the ramifications of that?
Well, I mean, I think the ramifications are serious, but I think what we do effective at Carolina's healthcare system is we proactively evaluate drug shortages, we centralize that inventory, and then we allocate it out to our 40-plus facilities as needed. So it's a proactive approach where we've been able to stay ahead of the curve.
And kind of an example of how I saw that play out is, so that day, Kevin Isaacs, it was at CMC that specific day, but I mean, he showed me how these drugs, if you go to the trays are stocked, right? So they have the drugs they need in the emergency trays. If you go to then kind of the central pharmacy where they're in theory would be backups, some of these drugs, there are no backups. Literally all of the ones they have are in the trays. So in theory, if you use one of these drugs in the tray that day,
they're out.
In theory, yeah. Some of these, like, there was a little example, not to get too technical, but it was there's this one example of dextrose, which is a drug that's used both for children and for adults. It kind of helps them. It helps with their blood pH. Bob, does that sound like a good simple way to describe that? So essentially, if you had somebody whose pH was crashing, this is an example of an emergency situation. You know, it's this very simple thing. It's ready to go. You grab it out of the tray. You give it to the adult or the kid, and that's one of the things that helps them stabilize. Well, if you're running out of the child dose of this dextrose syringe, and that was the example that they pointed out to me that day, what that means is, okay, either we don't have this child dose, that's okay, we can use the adult dose, we have to dilute that down, we have to change the concentration, and a nurse has to be doing all these things while someone is potentially unconscious in an emergency situation. So, I mean, it just adds even more risk to situations that are inherently risky because of where they're happening and what's going on with the patients.
Now, Jay Campbell, you're the executive director of the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy. I'm not particularly certain what that board does. Maybe you can tell us and how you interface with this problem.
Well, I'm disappointed, Mike. We talked about the show, right? So it didn't leave much of an impression. Well, the Board of Pharmacy, our job is twofold, essentially. It's one is to make sure that those who would practice pharmacy and the facilities in which pharmacy would be practiced or have the requisite, meet the requisite qualifications to do that safely. And then, of course, the second part of the flip side of that coin is to make sure that those who are practicing pharmacy in the places where pharmacy is practiced continue to meet legal standards. So the Board of Pharmacy doesn't have any role as such in determining what is or is not a shortage drug. I think what often happens is that boards of pharmacy around the country try to be available as an informational source to help pharmacists know what the resources are for determining shortages, et cetera, and certainly to the extent that compounding becomes a means by which pharmacies struggle to provide critical access drugs to their patients, and that can involve Board of Pharmacy oversight.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about people trying to game the system later on in the program. And that is where you get involved.
We have certainly had some amount of involvement with those who, as I think you charitably put it, try to game the system. I might come up with other adjectives or verbs, but they might not be fit for public consumption.
Now, I've seen a national news report on this. I forgot where I saw it or how long ago it was. I think it was about a year ago. And they concentrated on chemotherapy drugs because a lot of people are affected by a shortage of a chemotherapy drug. They may be embarking on a course of treatment where the drug of choice, the ideal drug, is not available, or they may be in the middle of something and suddenly it isn't unavailable. And then they have to decide, do I go off the treatment for 9 weeks or however long it takes, or do I change drugs, and what will that do for me? And this is not just adults we're talking about here. We're talking about children. Which cancer drugs, chemotherapy drugs, seem to be in short supply, and is it chronic or does it change from month to month, week to week?
It changes, and from my understanding, Bob, you tell me if this sounds right, it sounds like some of the chemotherapy drugs have, the shortages have eased somewhat. They're still in short supply, but I guess they're a little easier to get.
Absolutely.
But I remember, so last year, for example, two of the really big ones, it was methotrexate, which was used for kids with a certain type of cancer. I can't remember exactly what type it was. But then, and then it was also Doxil, which was also used, I think, for was that children as well, or was that adults?
Both, adults.
Both. So, I mean, you had these two drugs, and I remember at hospitals, it got to the point, I think this is the last time you had headlines about this, Mike. I mean, this was the last time that there was some outcry because, you know, you heard these stories of hospitals who were you know, literally running out of this basic drug they needed to treat children who had cancer. There were manufacturing problems. It was a wide variety of things. But anyway, long and the short of it is the FDA had emergency shipments from overseas to ease that shortage. And actually, I reported on that last year. And how I first even got back into this series was, you know, we wanted to see, okay, what's happened? Have things improved at all? And as we're calling around, so yeah, hospitals have an easier time getting these two drugs, but they're still in short supply. They're still listed as current shortages, and the manufacturing side of it still hasn't gotten much better. I mean, the only reason that the shortages have eased is because of these overseas shipments. So it is just remarkable to me to find this out, that, you know, this, the one issue that kind of got everybody up in arms, it really still hasn't even been fully resolved.
But drugs from overseas aren't safe. We all know that. I'm being facetious here.
Right, yes.
Right. But seriously, a lot of these cancer drugs are now coming from overseas. Why is that okay if we can't buy drugs like Tylenol from Canada?
I think it becomes a matter of life and death. I think Tylenol is not a life-threatening Tylenol doesn't have an indication for life-threatening.
I'm exaggerating, but I mean, people tried to buy like blood pressure medications and Lipitor and things like that from Canada because it's cheaper in Canada because everything's more expensive
right.
here.
And, so, and the control.
But we can't do that because the FDA says it's not safe from Canada. Right. How can it be safe from Poland, a cancer drug?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question. I don't know if anybody has a clear answer for that other than that because these drugs are medically necessary to treat specific mm-hmm. cancers and it becomes a life and death situation, then obviously the drug becomes more important and the importation becomes okay.
So what do doctors do?
I think, Mike, if I could, I think there's two, when you think about importation in these circumstances, that there's a significant qualitative difference between the kind of importation you were describing, which is someone decides I'd like to get my medications more cheaply from Canada, and so I purport to order them from a, you know, Maple Leaf Pharmacy or whomever. And study after study has shown that, in fact, a significant portion of the time that the drugs the patients are getting are from locations other than Canada and very often are something very different from what they purport to be. But I do think that's different, at least qualitatively, from a situation where the FDA is going in and doing its own inspections and specific oversight of importation of a critical access drug from a foreign country.
Let me stop you there because I have to take a break, Jay Campbell. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heath Springs Residential Care Center, providing family-oriented long-term assisted living for the elderly in historic Heath Springs, South Carolina for almost 20 years. Details at heathspringsrcc.com. For years, the nation's two political parties have been at loggerheads. Each one of them has a point of view, and neither one of them wants to give an inch on anything. So it's led to gridlock, unlike anything we've seen in the modern era. But there is a ray of hope, believe it or not, among a group of freshman congressmen from both sides of the aisle. And that group is led in part by North Carolina Congressman Robert Pittenger. He will join us along with his cohort from Florida to talk about this ray of sunshine and what it might mean for politics and Washington tomorrow at 9.
This piece of tape that you're about to hear is actually about social policy. Seriously.
Right. How's that net feel?
Thank God for this net.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Show me your safety net next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the chronic drug shortage faced by hospitals across the country, which they've faced for several years, and which was the highlight or highlighted in a series of stories last week. Or, yes, I guess it was last week, called Critical Supply. Michael Tomczyk from WFA News reported on that story, and he's joining us now, if I could just get it out. Bob Carta is Vice President of Pharmacy Services of Carolina Healthcare System, and Jay Campbell joins us by phone from Chapel Hill. He's the Executive Director of the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy. I had to interrupt you in the middle of something, Jay, before the break. You're talking about the difference between the kinds of drugs we order overseas in these critical drug shortage situations versus ordering your drugs from a Canadian pharmacy just for yourself. Did you finish what you had to say, or do you have more?
And I do apologize for running into the break, but the general point I was making was that these are qualitatively two very different types of importation. And when FDA is going in to facilitate the importation of a critical access shortage drug, this isn't just over-the-transom type importation, which studies have shown very often involve drugs that are certainly not from Canada and often are not the drugs they purport to be. It's a more very direct oversight of an importation, which I'm not suggesting that's perfect, but I think, as Bob mentioned, when you're weighing the risk-benefit of needing a critical access drug, given the amount of oversight here, I think the risk-benefit profile looks a lot better than just sort of general importation by individuals who are seeking cheaper drugs.
And Michael, you talked to the FDA about this. That's pretty much what they told you, or was there more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, to Jay's point, I mean, the FDA would only work with overseas manufacturers that have, you know, sterling reputations with whatever their regulator is overseas. For example, some were from Australia, some were from Europe. And the idea is that you go to a manufacturer that's been producing products for a long time, that has a good reputation with the regulatory boards, wherever they are, and that the FDA, you know, is now starting to have relationships with some of these because of how these shortages are drawing out. So there are some situations now where, because, say, we took overseas shipments from this one company in Australia 2 years ago, if something related comes up, the FDA, and this doesn't happen too often, I don't want to characterize this as this happens all the time, but the FDA at least kind of has some manufacturers overseas now that it can say, okay, this worked in a previous case. We can, you know, make sure they're checked out and make sure this is a, you know, mm-hmm. kind of the lesser of however many evils we have here with the shortages.
In your series last week, you reported that the vice president of the association representing major drug manufacturers says the cause of this shortage is that roughly 30% of the approved available facility production lines are currently offline. 30% are not operating. Why?
So there are a couple things at play. Let's start with these products, as Bob said earlier, they're generics. So you have to make a massive amount of them if you're going to actually turn a profit. There are only a handful of companies that do that. So part of the issue is you only have a couple companies. So if there's a quality issue at one of these and they have to shut down a line, I mean, that at the snap of a finger can just cause a shortage because there aren't enough other companies. There's not enough other production space to ramp up to meet the need when all of a sudden you have all these hospitals whose source is wiped out. So,
why doesn't the Walmart principle hold here? Seriously, now we hear from drug manufacturers of the onerous weight put on their shoulders by the FDA to do research and development, which is why they have to charge so much for the new drugs and why they want to hold on to those patents for as long as they can to make back their R&D costs. Then these drugs go generic, and these drugs become, it seems to me, very inexpensive to make because there are no R&D costs involved. And now you're telling us that the profit margins on these drugs are not sufficient enough to warrant your wanting to spend the time and the effort to make to put them into production. How can it be this way? You're giving me the evil eye, Bob.
The cost to bring a drug to market, number one, takes years and years and years, and the cost is enormous. And so, yes, even though they have a patent for 7-10 years, those costs are recouped. But they also have to pour all that money into future R&D for new drugs. So there is some justification for that. When the drug goes generic, usually there's many manufacturers going into the market and the price dips really mm-hmm. quickly. And so,
but there's a never-ending need for this drug. This is a permanent revenue stream for whoever is making this generic drug. Why would they walk away from that?
Because that revenue stream is tiny. I mean, it's really not much money. And just to be clear, too, I mean, the drugs we're talking about.
What does that mean, it's really not much money? Because the hospitals will charge you $100,000 for the drug. What's not much money?
I'm not
kidding. No, I am not kidding. I read Stephen Brill's article in Time magazine about the called Bitter Pill, and you guys charge an enormous amount of money for these drugs. So maybe it's warranted. I'm just saying that you charge that much money. So I'm just saying, how much money is too much?
Well, some of the, I mean, to be real clear, real quick, I mean, these generics are not, you know, a lot of the time they're I'm not going to speak for the hospital prices of them, but at least as far as the manufacturer side of things, it's not like these drugs are fresh off patent, Mike. I mean, these drugs have been generic for a very long time. These are staples in chemotherapy treatment and IV fluids and
anesthetics. Aspirin is a staple, and I can go to any drugstore in the country and buy it right now. By any number of manufacturers. So you tell me the difference.
Well, I think some of the difference is aspirin's an oral medication. A lot of these medications are IV. They are much more difficult to produce.
Okay.
The quality controls within the drug manufacturing plant has to be up to standard. The FDA has put more quality control measures into place, and so a lot of the manufacturing lines have been shut down. Unfortunately, the FDA doesn't have enough personnel, so when the manufacturing plants are ready to come back online, they don't have enough personnel to recertify.
Why don't they have enough personnel?
The FDA?
Yes.
Why? We're in the season of sequestration, Mike. Why does it any
is
kind of government agency?
Is?
Not,
is
no, I mean, sequestration isn't to them, but it's just the idea of, you know, this is just kind of the way I think a lot of things in our government work now, and that, you know, you have a certain amount of money that's budgeted to make these things work. But keep in mind, I mean, 5 years ago, this wasn't even a major problem on anybody's radar. So I think as this problem has grown, I don't think there's been the adjustment in personnel to allow the FDA to adequately keep up with it. And just to boil down for you real quick, I think, you know, why this isn't like aspirin. As Bob said, these are drugs that are injected into patients. They're generic injectable drugs.
Okay.
So if there is anything in that solution, it can literally be deadly. I mean, think about the meningitis outbreak that started with tainted solutions from a compounder in Massachusetts. I mean, that's the risk if these are not completely sterile drugs. So then the argument becomes, is the FDA being more strict about finding things in manufacturing lines that could lead these to be sterile or not sterile? And you know, that I think that's a good question. I mean, there's this issue between, you know, what's the safest quality and kind of what's good enough. And obviously, you know, I don't think any patient wants to hear good enough.
Jane, is the Board of Pharmacy, I know that you deal with pharmacies and pharmacists. Do you also deal with drug manufacturers?
No, we do not have any jurisdiction to regulate drug manufacturers.
But you do deal with some people who compound drugs. Is that correct?
We do. Certainly any pharmacy that compounds prescription drugs, that pharmacy is regulated by the Board of Pharmacy.
So from your experience and the regulations that you put on it at the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy and the regulations that you know come from the Food and Drug Administration, are the standards incredibly difficult and very expensive to comply with?
You mean for an FDA-registered manufacturer?
Yes, or somebody who compounds drugs
there's no question that the regulations that govern drug manufacturers who are regulated primarily by the FDA, they're called GMPs or good manufacturing practices. They are very onerous, very expensive to comply with, and I'm not suggesting that's not necessary.
Are they more so than they were in the 1970s or 1980s when we never heard about a shortage of drugs?
My guess to that, and it's only a guess, Mike, would be that GMPs probably are more stringent now than they were in the 70s, and I would guess as quality control science has improved over a period of 40 years. I imagine, as with all things of that nature, that standards have changed accordingly. I unfortunately couldn't give you any sort of longitudinal analysis of what the amendments have been and haven't been to FDA regs.
But, Bob, you're nodding in agreement.
Well, I think, these standards have been around forever. I think like everything else, these manufacturing lines have become antiquated. So to bring them up to par, bring them up to quality control, I think the FDA has put a little more pressure on the drug manufacturers.
I want to go back, without being flip, up to Stephen Brill's article in Time magazine called Bitter Pill, which was the entire magazine. They've never done that before. And it was on costs in hospitals. It pointed to enormous markups at hospitals for everything, including drugs, and enormous profits at the drug companies. How can there be enormous profits on drugs while at the same time the profit margins make it unattractive for a drug manufacturer to keep up with demand, which is never ending?
Well, I don't think the drug profits in the generic world are excessive for the pharmaceutical manufacturers. I think it's really the brand names, the blockbuster drugs, the Lipitors of the world, and et cetera, where all the money for the drug companies, the profits going for R&D. As far as hospital prices, our prices at Carolina's healthcare system are based on the cost of the drug with a markup based on how much it takes us in terms of distribution and clinical knowledge to get that drug to the patient. So, I could disagree with you a little bit that they're excessive.
You're disagreeing with Stephen Brill. Everything I know about this came from that article.
Alrighty.
However, if I'm a drug manufacturer and I know that Carolina's healthcare system and Novant and every hospital in the country is going to be ordering from me my cancer drug every day, or my, what was that, is it dextrose that you were talking
dextrose.
About?
Dextrose.
Yeah.
Dextrose. Emergency drug.
Yeah. Every day. Every day I'm going to get a steady stream of orders. Why would I walk away from that? Why would I shut down my production lines? Why would I say, I got better things to do today than make that drug?
Well, think about that. If that generic drug, your profit is a penny a dose,
yeah,
versus I can put on that production line something that make me a dollar a dose, uh-huh, I'd probably increase the production of the dollar dose.
Well, and also it gets down to dollars and cents, which is actually something astutely Bob told me as we were talking before this started. But here's how you can think of it, Mike. So these drugs, if you have a shutdown, it can be enormously expensive to update your line to FDA standards if the FDA come in and says there's something wrong with this line. One of the manufacturers, just to give an example, Bedford, is redoing a line, and it's going to cost them it's close to, I think, $100 million to redo this line. So, I mean, you have this enormous cost to fix it. So then the question becomes, how long is it going to take me to make money off these generic products to basically pay back the investment I'm going to put into this line? And although I think now most of the major manufacturers are choosing to do these fixes, you could argue that maybe a little bit ago you had more just say, you know what, we're just not going to make this drug anymore because it's going to cost too much for us to start making it again.
Is this problem particular to the United States, or is this a worldwide problem?
I'm not totally sure on that, Bob.
I believe it's – I don't know the answer either.
Because if you're getting drugs from overseas, it must – they're there. They're available.
Absolutely. So I believe, Jay, maybe you could comment, but I believe this is more specific to the United States. I have not read that this is a worldwide problem.
Jay?
I haven't read that it's a worldwide problem. I don't know the answer, though, Mike. I would note that, a lot of times, at least for brand name drugs, for lack of a better term, if you get a production line shut down for that, for a lot of those drugs, it's not like there's a production line in the United States and there's a production line in Western Europe and a production line in Australia. I imagine that in some cases, certainly a shutdown of a production line that affects the United States supply would affect other countries. But for generic drugs specifically, I'm quite certain that there's a much wider spread of manufacturers worldwide. And so my sense would be that an FDA shutdown of a manufacturing line for a generic drug or a staple, I think, Michael, you hit it right on the head. It's not just enough to talk about a generic drug, but to talk about drugs that you think of as the staples, there's probably lots of manufacturers around the country that are answerable to their particular country's regulatory standards. And my suspicion would be that for those types of drugs, an FDA shutdown would not have a tremendous effect on the worldwide market.
And Jay, I wanted to comment that, you know, one thing we haven't addressed is 80% of all drugs produced in the United States, 80% of those raw materials have to be imported from foreign countries, from Europe, from India, from China. And as we know, there could be political disturbances in these countries, there could be transportation issues, there could be trade disputes. So sometimes if 80% of our raw materials need to come from a foreign country, that creates another drug shortage.
Do we not have those raw materials available in any form in our country? They have to come in from other countries?
Absolutely.
What are they?
A lot of these raw materials are plants. A lot of drugs are produced from plants that we don't grow in this country for whatever reason, space, whatever, the climate, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a little while ago, Michael, about the outbreak of tainted medication coming from a compounding center in New England, which resulted in some meningitis problems. And you reported that the FDA is finding a lot more manufacturing lines just aren't good enough, and that a lot of the companies that are experiencing shortages do so because they're under quality compliance scrutiny by the FDA. Is the FDA being too strict? Is it suddenly catching up and shutting things down before they hurt us? I mean, are these manufacturers between a rock and a hard place?
So here's the FDA's argument. The FDA's argument to that, when I asked someone from the FDA, you know, if you've got nearly a third shut down, kind of what are you doing to try to help manage the shortages? Their take was some of these manufacturing lines are just getting old. I think Bob brought this up earlier. They need substantial investment to be fixed, and this is the FDA's take. Because they're getting older, you're going to have more problems. There are going to be some more just things that need to be updated, that need to be cleaned up so that you can make sure that these are safe drugs. So, it's funny. I think the manufacturers are somewhat between a rock and a hard place, but honestly, I think the FDA is too, because, I mean, they've got two jobs. Their job is both to their top job is to make sure that I think people in the United States are getting safe and quality drugs. I mean, that's, you know, in their charter. But they now have also taken on this major role with drug shortages, and sometimes the solution to one causes a problem in the other. So it can be very difficult, I think, to try to figure out how to manage this. I think this is part of the reason the problem's not going away.
You also reported that Congress passed a law last year requiring manufacturers to give, I think, 6 months' notice before they suspended a manufacturer of a particular drug so that other companies could ramp up production or hospitals could stockpile what was available. Has that helped?
No, I think, number one, certainly at Carolina's healthcare system, stockpiling is not the solution because you create a downstream effect for everybody else. So I think that—
robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Exactly, and I think it's the proactive approach that we've taken that's been a national model. I think, though, as far as— I forget the question.
Has the congressional law helped?
Oh, it has not, because I really think the FDA does not have jurisdiction to levy any fines over the drug manufacturer. So it's really a lax system.
I'm going to ask a question too, Bob, to your point about the FDA. One might fairly question, what would that accomplish? I mean, obviously, FDA can't order a manufacturer to start making a particular product. And if you start saying, well, now we're going to fine you or bring some other punitive consequence down because we don't think you notified us in sufficient time, it might be a fair question as to whether that improves matters or if that makes the financial pressures that may be contributing to the drug shortage worse.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back, and I'm going to follow up on something that you just said. The FDA cannot order a manufacturer to do this. This is certainly morally wrong, the drug shortage. It's not illegal, but should we be able to order a manufacturer to do this? We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bi-Lo Supermarket, serving the Southeast for over 50 years, introducing new bonus fuel perks at Bi-Lo with the Bi-Lo Bonus Card. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks program details at buy-lo.com. Nurse practitioners in a number of states are pressing lawmakers to let them practice without doctor supervision. Critics cite the risk of a lower standard of care. Debate over expanding the authority of nurse practitioners, the topic in 20 minutes. At 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation about America's drug shortage, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
AM A persistent death toll in an unexpected place.
My son died in terror. He didn't die in peace. He died in terror. And it didn't have to happen.
Parents grieve for sons dying in grain bins, and they claim regulators go easy on employers defying the law. Later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Michael Tomsic from WFAE News, who reported last week in a series on the critical shortage of drugs facing hospitals around the country. He's expanding on that for us today. Bob Carta is Vice President of Pharmacy Services at Carolina's Healthcare System, and Jay Campbell joins us by phone from Chapel Hill, where he's the Executive Director of the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy. When you're looking at not having at your disposal as a doctor or a hospital a drug that is absolutely critical to the health or survival of one of your patients, it becomes a moral issue. It is certainly immoral, it seems to me, to deliberately stop production on a needed drug because you're not making enough money as the drug manufacturer, but it's not illegal. So the question becomes, should it be illegal, or should the government be able to say to a drug manufacturer, if you're going to supply these other drugs, then you must make this critical drug? Should we be able to do that?
I think in an ideal situation, yes. The answer is yes. I think it's like everything else. The FDA can expedite new drug reviews. They can encourage the drug manufacturers to stay in the market. But at the end of the day, they don't have any direct jurisdiction if the drug company wants to get out.
If it's not profitable for a company, and companies cannot lose money because they will go out of business. So if it's not profitable to make a certain drug, should we be exploring the idea of opening up some sort of a nonprofit drug manufacturer that's subsidized by the government for these critical drugs that we need and no one wants to make anymore?
I think there is proposed legislation out there to keep pharmaceutical manufacturers into the generic market where the profits are pretty low, that maybe the government's going to have to subsidize.
But, Bob, we're all being encouraged by our insurance companies. We're being told by our insurance companies under certain circumstances to not get certain drugs, get the generic versions because it's cheaper. How can it be, if they're pushing people toward generics, why isn't the volume making up for the difference? I don't understand this. It works at Walmart incredibly well.
Well, it's the opposite end of the line, though. I mean, your insurance company encouraging you are the very last step in this chain that starts with raw material, goes to manufacturers, goes through primary wholesalers, goes to hospitals, goes to hospital pharmacies. Then you get it. So I mean, you're at the very end of this step, and I don't think that there's enough power. The other thing, too, is let me ask this. Mike, last time you went to a hospital, you know, say it was for – did you have any – you know, did the doctors talk through which anesthetic you would like or which things in your IV fluids you would like? I mean these are basic things they use for everybody. I don't think we're getting
– Actually, I had a procedure, and the guy told me that the normal anesthetic that we use is in short supply.
Well,
so we won't be using that. We'll be using propofol.
It's a great drug.
To which I said, oh, the one that killed Michael Jackson. Great.
Wonderful. And that one actually has also gone into short supply.
And that wasn't at a CHS hospital.
No, it wasn't. All right. Let me take a couple of phone calls, and then I want to get into the secondary drug wholesaler topic here for a second or two. Let me go to Lawrence in Charlotte. Lawrence, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Hey, Mike. As usual, another great show.
Thanks.
Listen, you've touched on a lot of things that I was going to say. But I'd like to just point out a few things. First of all, previous Republican administrations and Congresses have gutted the FDA's power and the funding for the FDA so that they can't actually put people in the field. It's like the meat inspectors and all of the other inspection arms of the government, and sequestration hasn't really helped. As far as suppliers are concerned, there have been a lot of problems with China and other areas, and the FDA has to go and inspect these suppliers, and so that's another big problem. The production issue is somewhat like the gasoline shortages that we see. Somehow the gasoline manufacturers manage to shut down, and then when they open, the prices end up, going back up again, or they go up while the things are shut down. A prime example of this for the drugs are tetracycline for tick bite. you know, that was in short supply for a while. It's coming back. But I asked my pharmacist the other day about this, and he said that the price has gone up like tenfold on a generic pill. So one solution I had, which you just mentioned, is to actually have national manufacturing facilities, because this is really an issue of national security. If there were, you know, some kind of a problem in the United States and we had these shortages, we'd be, you know, as bad off as having our power supply shut down or, you know, anything else. So those are some of my comments. And I'm an MD, so I've had some direct experience with this.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Yeah. Let me go to Dan in Charlotte. You're on WFAE. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Michael, for taking my call. Just my question is, there are a number of, you know, encounters I experienced in terms of the price of drug. Actually, you know, I live overseas for a long time, and after coming to U.S., I just find out most of the things that I buy less than $2 for, you know, a refill. Most probably here it might cost me about $30 after the insurance, you know. So I just want to ask how, you know, some of the stuff which are even coming from overseas end up, you know, costing us like 100, 200 times, even sometimes 1,000 times here. And I don't understand the situation. I just
why are drugs that are one price in Europe or some other country 1,000 times more expensive in the United States? And that includes the hospital drugs, because Stephen Brill wrote about it. It must be true.
I don't have the answer to that. I do know that in the United States, we pay proportionally more for the cost of drugs than any other
country.
Is that
because we're subsidizing the rest of the world, or is that because of the way our healthcare system is set up to allow it? Because it's not a single payer system. Is that why?
It could be a combination of all three.
Or you know that to be the case.
I do not know it to be the case. I don't know, Mike, if you do or.
Jay, feel free to chime in here if you like, but as far as the – I can't speak to that issue, but as far as the prices for these shortage drugs, I mean, it is kind of a supply and demand thing. When you have to go – when a hospital has to go away from their normal contract with their primary wholesaler, which is how they usually get most of their drugs, when they have to go off that contract to get drugs that are in short supply from someone else, say a compounder or another manufacturer or another direct from the manufacturer or another wholesaler, they have to spend a lot more for these drugs. So it's because, you know, supply and demand. When it's in short supply, you can charge more for these drugs.
Is that why they're in short supply? Because you can charge more for them if they're in short supply? Deliberately in short supply?
No, I mean, I really do think that, I mean, if you look at the FDA reports, I mean, there are nearly a third of the manufacturing lines that are closed for quality issues. So, I mean, that would have to be a giant conspiracy if the FDA is trying to help the manufacturers make money.
No, I'm not saying that they're involved in it. I'm just saying the manufacturers. Dan, thank you for your call. That leads us to something called secondary drug wholesalers. And I'm told that they may play a role in making this problem worse. What are secondary drug wholesalers, and are they making the problem worse?
So real quick to start, I mean, there are some secondary wholesalers who are helping to kind of fill a void, but there are also some that you would refer to as gray market wholesalers. That's what kind of the regulators in this issue describe the problem as, a gray market where it gets out of the normal supply chain that hospitals use to get drugs. You will have these wholesalers and pharmacies set up shop basically with the sole intention of buying drugs that are in short supply, holding on to those drugs, and then I guess what they're actually spending their money on is call staff, because they have people calling and emailing hospital pharmacists constantly, like used car salesmen is the way one of my sources described it to me, how they sound, saying, oh, have you heard about propofol? It's in short supply right now. You better buy up. We've got this. We'll sell it to you at this price. You should do this right now.
Because it might not be here tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah. If you don't buy this, you're not going to get any. You've got to buy from us. Mm-hmm. And then that's putting pressure on hospitals to figure out, okay, is there actually a problem here? Or are we okay? But then also, it's just kind of creating this whole atmosphere of like anxiety that goes on top of what they're managing.
So, Jay Campbell, how many of the secondary drug wholesalers operate in North Carolina, and how many of them operate in that manner?
Well, you asked the wrong guy that question. Actually, wholesalers are regulated in North Carolina by the Food and Drug Safety Division of the Department of Agriculture. So, I couldn't quote you those sorts of figures. I can certainly talk about at least one case we've had in which the Board of Pharmacy and the Department of Agriculture cooperated to put a stop to this type of behavior.
And many times these wholesalers, these secondary market wholesalers, buy and sell from each other. and they do it several times a day sometimes, and each time there's a markup. So each time the price of the drug continues to rise. So by the time the hospital gets to it, it is far more expensive than it would have been if they could have bought it from their original supplier. Why is that legal, or is it?
So it is, and this is where it gets kind of murky. But so in North Carolina, first of all, most of these things are regulated by states. There really is no federal law that really has anything to do with the gray market. Congressman Elijah Cummings from Maryland is one of the people who's trying to work to change that right now. But most of these come down to state regulations. And in North Carolina, we have good regulations as far as whether wholesalers can get drugs from an unlicensed wholesaler or from a pharmacy that's acting like a wholesaler. The answer is they can't. That would be illegal. And what Jay just mentioned, there was one example in North Carolina. It was called International Pharmaceuticals that was buying drugs from a pharmacy that was literally set up in the same shop. And it was the pharmacy was acting like a wholesaler. That's what was illegal. But to
so
answer
the
your
pharmacy
original,
was buying drugs legally in the normal manner and then selling them to their own wholesaler who was jacking up the price and sending it out.
Yeah, and then so from that wholesaler, you went to other wholesalers, and each step in the chain, the price goes up. And to answer your original question, there's nothing illegal about that.
No, but you know, if this were gasoline after a hurricane or chainsaws after a hurricane, the state would come in and say you're not allowed to price gouge; it's illegal. This is price gouging. They can raise the prices as much as they want, and in the face of a critical shortage, just as it would be in critical shortage of gasoline, why is it not legal? Why is it not illegal, rather?
Jay, I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
Well, I have often raised this very issue that we do in this state, and most states have some form of a statute that primarily, as you're alluding to, was put into place in the event of a natural disaster, for example, and folks are without power for days at a time. If somebody starts charging $100 for a bag of ice, they're probably going to go to jail for having done that. Mm-hmm. And I have always been curious as to why those profiteering statutes would not have an application in the context of a drug shortage. I expect that the answer is that however those statutes are drafted in North Carolina, they are probably very specific to declarations of emergency and the like that are tied typically to a national disaster, but I'm certainly not aware of any reason why a legislative body could not decide to extend those types of profiteering restrictions to include critical access drug shortage.
Has the hospital system, yours or Novant's or anybody else's in the two-state area, gone to the legislatures and said, look, we have a serious critical shortage of this drug. It's costing us far more to get this drug when we can get it. Stop, do something about this and stop it.
Well,
make it illegal.
Yeah, I can only address the Carolinas healthcare system, but I think the solution really is don't use them. I think
don't use what?
Don't use the gray market distributors. I mean, if you take a proactive approach like we have at CHS, and when we have dedicated personnel analyzing and predicting the drug shortage, we centralize that inventory, 40-plus hospitals. We then can reallocate it back out. We work with our medical staff on protocols, conservative use, decrease in waste, and you stay ahead of the curve. And I'm very proud to say that we have never our patients have never experienced a drug shortage.
But you have a person dedicated to that.
We have,
you're a very big hospital system.
We have several people.
And you also have buying power, it would seem to me, because you're a very big hospital system. What about smaller hospitals? What alternatives do they have?
Calling their legislators. That's their alternative. And that's literally what – so, for example, Northern Hospital in Mount Airy is one of the hospitals that I spent some time with for this series. The director of pharmacy there, he has called his senators. He has called his congressional representatives in North Carolina, left voicemails, sent letters, and hasn't heard much back, frankly, trying to tell them what a big deal this problem is and what the risks of it are. And he's kind of out on his own. I mean, if he can't get something, they have to try to go direct to the manufacturer and hope that works.
We've spent years in this country having this health care debate, and one of the things that keeps coming up over and over and over is the remarkable cost of health care in this country. And some estimates place the annual economic impact of drug shortages at over $400 million, with U.S. hospitals spending $200 million more each year purchasing more expensive generic medications or therapeutic substitutes. why are these more expensive if they're not making any money on these generics, number one? And number two, has this come up in the conversation, the fact that this is costing us money?
Yeah, I think the Premier Healthcare Alliance did this study of over 300 hospitals and came up with a $200 million excess expense. I think the real issue is that we're using dedicated personnel in our hospitals. We have to go out and buy drug alternatives to the drug shortage that are more costly. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, the healthcare system is absorbing quite a bit of $200 million a year.
And because these generics are more expensive, it doesn't mean that the money is going to the manufacturer. It's going to the people, the middle people.
It's going to the middle people, the drug distributor. It's not going to the healthcare system.
This is another example of how our healthcare system is broken, it seems to me. When you talk to people about this for your series, Michael, did anybody come up with any solutions to this?
Where to start? on the manufacturing side, it sounds like, I guess the hope would be, if the problem really is that these manufacturing lines are out of date and need to be updated, as they're going through these updates that they've been doing over the past couple of years, as they've been getting in more trouble, I guess the hope would be once they make all these fixes, the total percentage that's offline will go down. But as far as the other things that have outgrown from this problem, whether it's issues with compounding pharmacies, which hospitals go to as a last resort, whether it's issues with the gray market, there aren't really good there are more questions that I found than answers, is what I would say.
Michael Thompson's series, Critical Supply, can be heard in its entirety on our website at WFAE.org if you want to get more information about what he found out in the course of covering this all last week. Bob Carter is also with us, Vice President of Pharmacy Services at Carolina's Healthcare System, and Jay Campbell joined us from Chapel Hill, the Executive Director of the North Carolina Board of Pharmacy. Thank you all.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.